LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Laurie Endicott-Thomas, who joins us to discuss her book, Not Trivial, How Studying the Traditional Liberal Arts Can Set You Free. Why are there so many problems within our modern education system? In theory, our schools should be better than they've ever been, but growing numbers of people are embarking on their adult lives as functionally illiterate. Despite the best efforts of educators, much of the system is thus increasingly unfit for purpose. This has enormous implications for society in general, and politics in particular. Is this by accident or by design? Are there hidden agendas at work? Upon investigation, it would seem that the true purpose of compulsory state education is less about liberation and freedom of opportunity, and more about control, coercion, and churning out compliant consumers and obedient workers willing to take their allotted place in society's hierarchy. When direct oppression is no longer possible, deliberate dumbing down will do just as well. Hello and welcome, Laurie, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Laurie, today we're going to talk about your book, which is entitled Not Trivial, How Studying the Traditional Liberal Arts Can Set You Free. Before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your background and your work in general.
Okay, I'm an editor. I correct people's grammar for a living. I have corrected the grammar of some of the most extensively and expensively educated people in the United States. So that experience has given me kind of a bird's eye view of what's gone wrong in education in the United States.
Okay, well, as I said, the book's entitled Not Trivial, How Studying the Traditional Liberal Arts Can Set You Free. And for some listeners, that's going to be a little bit obscure. It's like, what exactly are we referring to here? So tell us about the traditional liberal arts, so-called, and the historical background to this. Because what we're really talking about here today is our education system and the effect that that has on the wider society, including the political realm. But the roots of what you're talking about, and again, this is where your book begins, really, are in the ancient world. So give us the background to all of this.
Okay, the story of the liberal arts dates back to ancient Athens. And ancient Athens was an interesting place to study politics because it was a relatively small-scale society, but it was at the corners, it was at the crossroads of the ancient world. So here was this society that was small enough to have a more or less democratic political structure. And yet it was near enough to these great civilizations such as Egypt and Sumeria and so forth that they could make use of all these technologies that had been developed by the great societies. And the Greeks then developed a writing system that was so simple to learn that literacy just expanded beyond any literacy level from any ancient society. So the Greeks then used this new writing system that was so easy to learn to write about a lot of the things that they learned from all these great societies. So that's why the Greeks are important, and that's why our discussion really starts in Athens. And in Athens, they had the educational system, or the curriculum, the things that people studied were based on seven basic subjects, seven basic disciplines. And these seven basic disciplines were believed to give a person a well-rounded education. And their word for well-rounded education gives rise to our word encyclopedia. So these seven subjects were divided into two basic groups. One group was the three arts of verbal arts, the three language arts, and they were the three courses were called the trivium, which meant three courses in Latin. Later on, when the Romans adopted these, they called it the trivium. And those three subjects were grammar, logic, and rhetoric. So grammar is the study of how words are altered and combined to form meaningful sentences. Logic is the study of how sentences about statements of fact are combined into arguments about what is true and false. So you can use some facts that you already know and use them to figure out some facts that you want to know through the use of logic. Then rhetoric was the art of persuasive speech, in which you used logic, an appeal to logic, an appeal which was called logos, or an appeal to reputation, which was called ethos, or appeal to feelings, which is called pathos, in order to persuade people. So these three subjects enabled you to develop logical thinking and argumentation. Now the other four subjects, which were called the quadrivium, which meant four subjects, were the studies of mathematics, geometry, music, and astronomy. Mathematics is the study of number. Geometry is the study of number and space. Music is the study of number and time. And astronomy is the study of number, space, and time. So if you put all of these studies together, if you put all these seven subjects together, it gives you the basic framework that you need to study just about anything else. And that's why these studies were considered to be so important. Now, the Romans embraced a lot of Greek culture, and one of the things that they embraced was these seven subjects. They were called the liberal arts because, as the Roman philosopher Seneca put it, they were appropriate for freeborn men as opposed to slaves. So the seven subjects of the liberal arts, these studies for free men, would help to prepare a young aristocrat for a career in the Senate. But it enabled them to think rationally, think for themselves, and express themselves persuasively. Now, on the other hand, slave owners didn't want their slaves to have those abilities. They wanted slaves to just do what they were told without giving them any back talk. So slaves were not taught the liberal arts. Instead, they were taught the servile arts, which made them better servants. And other working class people would be taught the mechanical arts that would make them better at pottery or weaving or baking or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. Today we still have to decide what we want to teach young people. And I feel that if you want to have a democratic society, you have to give everybody the basic disciplines in these seven subjects called the liberal arts.
Now, you mentioned the division between, you know, a liberal education and a more servile education, you know, back in the ancient world. A couple of things there, really. One side note is, how did, just briefly, how did this classical way, you know, this method of studying, you know, the world around us, of learning survive over, you know, the millennia, for example? Because, of course, we had a lot of turmoil over the centuries, not least of which, you know, the so-called Dark Ages. And where does that bring us to today, in the sense, because obviously reading your book, the sense is very strong that we have lost something along the way here in the last couple of hundred years in particular, which is affecting our current education system. So if you could address those two points briefly before we get into the modern situation in more depth.
Well, to understand how these things arose and survive, you have to understand that they were initially developed for practical purposes. For example, if you want to translate something, a piece of text from one language to another, you have to know grammar. Grammar is absolutely essential for people who want to learn to translate things. And so there's always been the need for grammar. And grammar has also been put to use it's the first step in studying philosophy. You have to understand what sentences mean before you can understand anything else. So grammar had that practical purpose of serving the needs of translators and so forth. So then logic, of course, and rhetoric are useful for any setting in which people are making decisions collectively. So when you had, for example, the church, when they had canon law and so forth, they needed to have people who could understand basic logic, basic principles of argumentation to work out problems like that. So at the end of the Dark Ages, when the churchmen started realizing the value of these things, then you had canon lawyers and so forth really devoting studies to devoting themselves to the study of logic. Also, you had, and rhetoric, of course, is useful for, again, persuasive speech. So whenever you need to persuade people as opposed to just using the rule of force, whenever, you know, there's always need to learn how for exhortation. So there's always been a need for that. Now, as for the quadrivium, mathematics arose out of the need to account for assets. So as long as there's been rich people, as long as there's been people who have to keep track of more stuff than they can just see, there's always been a need for accountancy. So there's been need for mathematics that way. Geometry was developed originally in Egypt, and the name Egypt meant the measured land. And it was really the need to work out lot lines and so forth in real estate. So whenever you have a situation such as in ancient Egypt where you had an agricultural society that floods and you had to redraw lot lines all the time because things got murky because of the changes to the landscape because of water, then you needed to have geometry. Music has all sorts of important purposes, not the least of which is military. If you need to move a large body of men through a narrow place, you have to have them marching in step. That's the purpose of marching, and that's the purpose of martial music. So, so this need for order and discipline within military ranks gave rise to the need to study music. And also music served important purposes in public festivals and so forth. And then, of course, the timing of public festivals and the calendar and the schedule of what was going to happen within a society, that was based on astronomy. So there was always a need for these basic subjects. And the writings on these subjects from ancient Greece and Rome and so forth were preserved at either end of what had been the Roman Empire. It was preserved partly by monks in Ireland and partly by Muslim scholars in North Africa and Western Asia. So when the Renaissance was the rebirth of this kind of learning, and it was partly because churchmen realized, well, gee, there's all this interesting stuff that this guy Aristotle wrote, and they started recovering those texts and translating them into Latin. Then there was from that, the wealthy families in northern Italy during the Renaissance, they discovered a need for a kind of education that would enable them to have productive and even pleasant political conversations within their social set. And they developed a curriculum to serve that need. That curriculum was then called the Studia Humanitatis, or the Studies of Humanity. Those studies included philosophy, history, language, literature, art, that sort of thing. And it's so today we call that the humanities. So when people talk about the liberal arts today as opposed in a liberal arts college, they generally mean the humanities as opposed to the liberal arts as they were conceived in ancient Rome.
Okay, well, we're basically, as I said earlier, we're going to be talking about the modern education system and the problems with it. Now, it occurs to me in listening to the historical background that you set out, that this idea of education, certainly post, you know, once, as you say, we emerged from Dark Ages into the medieval period and then the Renaissance, that mass education wasn't particularly an issue, you know, especially prior to the invention of the printing press. And then laterally, we know most people couldn't read or write anyway. At some point, that gradually began to change. And then in relatively recent history, you know, mass schooling started to come along in various parts of the world. And that's developed and developed to the point where, even though, of course, there's millions and millions of people around the world, children who don't get a chance at anything approaching what you and I would have experienced as children as an education, it's still considered to be the norm, something we should be aiming for. No child left behind, whatever you want to call it, all kids in school. But we have these tremendous problems with the ideals behind the system and what it actually delivers. Was there a point when the mass education system began to develop where it was moving in a positive direction, but it kind of got derailed at some point? Have there always been problems with this particular educational model? How would you characterize, you know, the development of mass schooling in that context?
Well, I described the development of public schooling in the United States in detail and not trivial. And the story starts off in 1642 in Massachusetts, when the legislature of the colony decided that they passed a law requiring all parents to ensure that their children learn to read and write. The purpose for this was very practical. They wanted the colony of Massachusetts to serve as a refuge for Puritans, for people of a particular religious persuasion. And that religious persuasion was very bookish. You had to be able to read the Holy Bible and read certain kinds of commentary on theology in order to be a good Puritan, in order to be a saint, as it were, in that society. So there was this expectation that every parent would teach their sons and daughters to read. And this expectation was then formalized into law. Now, this law was not always followed from the beginning, but it was at least a statement of best practices, as it were. I mean, this was the expectation was laid out in law. And then in 1647, the legislature of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts passed a law that has become known as the Old Deluder Satan Act. Now, the theory was that, the law states that because that old deluder, Satan, had originally kept the word of God from us by putting it in foreign languages, but now we have overcome that by having it translated into English and Bibles that are available to everybody. So now what's keeping people from the word of God is simply the fact that they cannot read. So the goal of the Old Deluder Satan Act was to require every community that was of the size of 50 households or more to hire a school teacher to teach all of the children in the town to read and write. And then the towns that were 100 households or more had to hire a schoolmaster to prepare the more promising boys for Harvard College. So this was partly as a farm team for the ministry, basically. So that was the purpose of education within Massachusetts at the time, and that's how they established this schooling system that then led to astonishingly high rates of literacy. By the mid 19th century in Massachusetts, there was a report about illiteracy in Massachusetts, and they said, well, illiteracy is a problem in Massachusetts, but only for people who didn't grow up here.
So I've read reports about, a little bit later than that, perhaps the late 19th century, about people saying, well, take a newspaper from back then, show it to your average person now, and chances are there's going to be words in there that they don't understand, or at the very least, the level that some of the newspaper pieces will be pitched at is way above what you would expect in a popular or tabloid newspaper today. So that's relatively recent history. So it seems that it was into the 20th century then that, and I know your characterization is restricted to the US, but we can see these patterns elsewhere, that problems seem to have begun to occur. And the question then is, how and why was that? Because there's a question of accident and design here, I think an element of both in some of the developments that began to take place.
Well, it is a combination of accident and design, but it's important to know the design first. And you can trace the design back to 1740 in South Carolina. Now, in 1739 in Carolina, there was a major, major slave uprising called the Stono Rebellion. And it struck fear into the hearts of slave owners. Now, as long as there's been slavery, there's been slave uprisings. And as long as there's been slavery, there's been attention to how the slaves can be controlled. Now, if you want to understand this whole mentality of how to control slaves and so forth, it's the best way to learn that kind of thing is to read the literature of ancient Rome, especially Seneca, the guy who was saying about the liberal arts being for free men, not for slaves. So, I mean, this idea of how to keep the slaves doing what you want them to do and not standing up for themselves, it is a problem that has been it was worked out in ancient times, and the people in the Americas, the wealthy, the planter class, and so forth. A lot of them had a classical education, so they'd read this literature in Latin, so they were aware of this kind of thing. So anyway, when the Stono Rebellion happened in 1739, well, after the dust settled from that, the legislature of the colony of South Carolina passed a piece of legislation called the Negro Act of 1740. Now, there were many different provisions of this act. One of them was that it established as a matter of law that every black person was an absolute and permanent slave. And any son or daughter of an enslaved woman was an absolute and permanent slave. So when one of the other provisions of this law was that if you were a slave, you could not leave your owner's property without written permission. Now, this system of control would break right down if slaves could read and write. As my friend Lawrence Ham, who's the chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, put it, well, if the slaves could write, they would write themselves their own deed saying, I hereby manumit myself, I hereby free myself. So in order to keep control over the slaves, they had to keep them from learning to write, especially learning to write, and even learning to read would enable them to send messages to each other to coordinate slave uprisings. So this was absolutely essential to the system of slave control. So you can see legislation similar to the Negro Act of 1740 was subsequently passed in all of the slave-owning areas in the United States. And these laws remained on in force until the passage of... some of them remained in force until the ratification of the 13th Amendment, which was on December 7th, 1865, which put an end to slavery. Because, all the laws applying to slaves were null then and void if there were no slaves. But then the rest of them, the ones about black people in general, those were overturned by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which was the equal protection clause. In other words, the laws have to apply equally to everybody. And I believe that one also established that the rights rights in the Bill of Rights apply, that have to be enforced by the states as well. So your right of freedom of speech and so forth, it was, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech from because of the 14th Amendment, and it now applies to the state governments as well.
Well, slavery abolished or not, there has always been, to some extent, a hierarchical structure to society. And as the time has passed since the abolition of slavery, nothing fundamental seems to have changed, although a lot of us like to think that it has. And in the 20th century, now into the 21st, that same requirement is there on behalf of certain factions to keep certain people in their place, to have society structured in a particular way. And the education system is central to this, I think.
Well, you're absolutely right, because the education system is the means by which we transmit culture to future generations. And it's the way of shaping the future. So it's always been central political concern. For example, when a lot of people say to me, oh, well, we should get the politics out of education. But politics is always, but education has always been a central concern of politics. Socrates was put to death because of a political offense related to education. So it's education has always been political, and it always will be. So the question is, what are people trying to achieve politically through influencing the education system? And I think that every responsible adult has to pay careful attention to that. So when after the end of slavery, you ended up with a system where we had the expectation from the northern states in particular that you would have free public education available to everyone. And then you had the tradition in the south of education being available only to people of a certain color, and to have systems of education that were available only to the privileged. So you have these two extremes, one where you had free access to education, basic education at the very least, to all, and the other where you had outright, on purpose, by law, deprivation of certain kinds of people. Now, you can't get away with that kind of thing. You can't get away with that kind of direct oppression once people have become aware that they don't have to put up with that kind of garbage any longer. And, in fact, the more openly you try to suppress somebody, the more likely you are to elicit some sort of backlash. And that principle is called the paradox of repression. So the more openly you oppress people, the more they fight back. So if you want to keep a lid on things, if you want to keep people in their place, you have to do it indirectly. You have to do it in ways that the people don't understand that they're being oppressed. So as long as they're being oppressed, as it were, indirectly, or in things that they don't understand are oppression, then you can get away with a lot. And the example that I gave in Not Trivial was the development of a bad method of teaching reading, which was developed, or at least it was introduced into Massachusetts in the 1840s under Horace Mann. Horace Mann was the first Secretary of Education of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And originally the education system in Massachusetts had been under the control of the Congregational Churches, which were the ecclesiastical wing of local governments. So there was a lot of local control, but it was under the control of a particular religious denomination. So there was dissatisfaction with that, especially as the First Great Awakening and the Second Great Awakening and so forth, as these rise of other Protestant denominations and Unitarianism, and then after the war, there was the rise of the Anglican Church and so forth, Episcopalian Church from the ashes of the Anglican Church, and you had Baptists and Methodists and so forth. So you had all these other groups that were competing with Congregationalists for power and influence. And after the Congregational Church was disestablished as the State Church of Massachusetts in the 1830s, then the Commonwealth of Massachusetts they set up their own statewide Department of Education, and Horace Mann was the first secretary of that Department of Education. And he put through a lot of important reforms, and some of them were badly needed. One was getting rid of corporal punishment in the schools. It used to be that you could be beaten by your teacher in school in Massachusetts, and he put an end to that. And New Jersey followed suit. It's been illegal for teachers to strike, or for school officials to strike students since the 1830s, at least in public schools. Lord knows what's gone on in private schools. So, but Mann did some bad things as well. And one of them was to import a model of education from Prussia. Now, Prussia had suffered a humiliating defeat by Napoleonic forces during the Napoleonic Wars. And in response, they put through some social reforms, including reforms to education. And one of the stated goals of their system of education was to shape the man so that he could not want anything other than what we want him to want. So it was a form of mind control. So instead of having people having loyalty to their noble landholder or their noble landlord or whatever, which under the feudal system, they had a modern industrial state where the people had they owed their allegiance to the king, and they had to practice obedience to their bosses and so forth. They were concerned about people being obedient to in their minds and so forth, but they wanted them to have their allegiance to the king as opposed to their local nobility. But one of the things that Horace Mann was enthralled by this kind of idea, partly because there was the rise of the textile manufacturing system, the factory system within Massachusetts, in particular in Lowell, and the girls who, young women, they were calling them the Lowell girls, they're mainly young women who were working in these factories, were surprisingly well educated by modern standards. And these women, when they started organizing labor unions, their labor union and labor unrest and so forth, they found this Unitarian minister who helped them publish their works in a magazine by and for themselves, but also that helped spread awareness of the labor movement's concerns to the broader population. And this was very unwelcome by the people who owned the factories. They did not want these girls to be able to use their writing skills and so forth to rally public support to their side. So in that social context, an educational reform that would undermine literacy and undermine especially higher functioning would be more than welcome. And the method that they found was to use a different method of reading instruction, which was to have people memorize whole words more or less as shapes instead of learning to sound the words out letter by letter.
Well, this is absurd, really, if you look at it. You know, we don't necessarily have time to get into it in a lot of detail, but this is opposed to phonics, basically. But the long story short, we have a situation now where in modern 21st century America, and I know this applies to other nations around the world, other comparable nations, but if you look at, for example, an index of literacy across European countries, Western European countries, and take in North America, you know, Canada and what have you, the US doesn't fare terribly well. So you have at least functionally illiterate masses, it has to be said, large numbers of people in North America, and you can trace the roots of this to the situation that you're describing. So what really sort of post-war, what is it that took place? I mean, you've described the background and some of the agendas here, what was going on, but that all that post-war optimism, you know, and everything was supposed to be getting better, schooling included, and, you know, literacy was only going to go up as people's education improved, as their prospects improved. It was supposed to be a one-way street, but of course, it was never that simple, really, was it?
Oh, it's never that simple. And I think people need to understand a little bit of political science if they want to understand this at all. And the basic principle that they need to understand is that education is a social institution, as schools are institutions and so forth. But what do you expect your school system to accomplish? And that expectation is going to vary from one person to another. If you are a parent of a child, you want that school system to provide that child with the kind of education that would enable that child to rise to have a good life. And that would be a combination of learning job skills that would enable the child to make a living, also just learning basic kinds of social skills that would enable them to become good people. So you want the educational system to help people to become healthy, wealthy, and wise, basically. And so that, I mean, if you're a parent want in your school to educate your child. That's what you want. On the other hand, if you're one of the people who controls the commanding heights of the economy, you may look at the education system differently. You may need the education system to sort people and to prepare people to occupy the various slots that are available in the systems that you control. And the best literary model I've ever seen for this is Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, where the human beings were not born to parents, but being raised in a hatchery, and they were being conditioned so that their destiny was decided from the time that they were artificially fertilized in the factory. And then the children who were being destined for the lower rungs of society were then deliberately stunted in their development. Whereas the children who were destined to be the alphas or even the alpha pluses in society were given all sorts of enrichment activities. So it was, so you see the same kind of tracking, it's called, in American schools, where you had some kids who were just kind of on a conveyor belt to the lower class, and some kids were being prepared for, they were considered to be college material, and they were, you know, prepared for a life in the, I guess what George Orwell would have called the lower upper middle class.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Brave New World, but of course 1984 comes into play here as well in terms of dystopian visions of the future. And it's been, even today when I talk to people about the education system as I experienced it, and my experience I think would have been considered in the grand scheme of things to be really rather good, or certainly relatively speaking. But I always had this feeling that people were, as you say, being groomed, some cases for better things than others. And, you know, I certainly experienced tracking or streaming, as we called it. There was five different streams in any given intake. And you weren't streamed immediately, of course. It was, well, you could be streamed by type of school that you would go on to. In the UK, we have primary, which is up to about age 10, 11, and then secondary until age 16, usually, or sometimes 18. So you could be streamed halfway through that, and that could have a huge effect on your life. Absolutely. And I saw it happen, you know, psychologically, how it affected people who were, you know, in the bottom 49% or whatever it happened to be. And then beyond that, there would be five streams, as I say, per intake, and that would get refined over the years. And then by the time you got to age 16, or those who stayed on after that, it began to be very clear what the authorities, what the teachers, or certainly the principal, you know, the people who were making the wheels turn, what they had in mind, sometimes even for individual pupils. But as I said at the start of this, when I talk about this, it's very much, you don't want to over egg that pudding, you know, don't exaggerate the situation. Things have become more egalitarian over time. But I don't really see it that way. I just see it as being more refined in the methods used to achieve these things. But, and I was going to say, you know, since the days of Edward Bernays and quite blatant propaganda, things have become more and more subtle. But in some ways, as the education system experiences more crises and, with greater numbers of people involved and begins to hit the buffers in various areas, my experience of things, even second, third hand, is once again seems to be more blatant. You know, it does seem to be more obvious, some of the agendas that are at play.
Well, part of the reason why so many people don't understand what's going on is that they haven't been textbook editors. I've edited textbooks for a living. I've edited textbooks on education. I've edited textbooks on all sorts of things. And one of the things that struck me from editing education textbooks was that the education world within academia in the United States is a kind of a separate soundproof booth from the rest of academia. You have teachers, colleges, and so forth. And the teachers are taught all sorts of theories and so forth that would be laughed out of the room if you tried to, introduce that kind of theory in a regular psychology class, as opposed to an education psychology class in an education school. And the reason I say that is if you go to my website, nottrivialbook.com, I post a letter that had been an open letter to the Secretary of Education of Massachusetts back in the 90s, when this whole language method of teaching language arts was all the rage, and there were people wanting to introduce it into the schools in Massachusetts. And there's this group of 40 of the world's top linguists and psycholinguists wrote a letter to the Secretary of Education saying, no, don't allow this whole language method to be introduced in our schools. It makes no sense. It's based on bad science. It's been a disaster wherever it's been tried, and we have no idea why people keep promoting it. And so so you get these bad theories that keep getting taught to teachers. And for example, this use of sight words for teaching reading is a disaster. We've known it since the 1840s, when it was a disaster in Massachusetts. Fast forward, but nevertheless, Horace Mann may have lost that battle, but he eventually won the war because he got to handpick the people who were to be teaching in the teachers' colleges. And that's where a lot of the power is exercised within the educational system, is this power to appoint people to be teachers within teachers' colleges, and the power to give educational grants to teachers, or to, you know, grants to people who are trying to promote different kinds of things within education. So this is how these foundations manage to have an effect on schools all over the country. So when this word at a time, the whole word method, sight word method, look and say, it's been called all sorts of different things. It was shown to be a disaster in Massachusetts. And a group of 31 schoolmasters in Boston published a book at their own expense to explain why it was a stupid idea and why it was, and that it was a failure. But nevertheless, it persisted within the schools of education within the United States, within the teachers' colleges. So the teachers kept getting taught this kind of thing. And then in the 1920s, there had been a terrible, terrible outbreak of what was called congenital word blindness in Iowa. And the Rockefeller Foundation sent this neurologist named Samuel Orton out to Iowa to figure out what on earth is going on. Why is it that there's this sudden epidemic of inability to read amongst the school children in Iowa? And what Orton found was that the problem was not in the children. The problem was in the schools. It was this use of this sight word method. And he found that the more sight words that you try to cram into a child's head before you teach that child phonics, the worse their dyslexia is. And the solution dyslexia, this inability to read, they call it dyslexia to make it sound like a medical problem as opposed to being just plain illiteracy. Dyslexia was actually the result of using sight words for teaching reading. And the solution to this problem was to use intensive phonics to teach reading. Now, Orton also noticed that this inability to read was causing frustration and anger, and it was causing personality, character, and behavioral problems in the children. And these character and behavior problems tended to go away if you taught them to read. So nowadays, with all this emphasis on what they call attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which is really a wastebasket term. There's no single entity that should be given as a diagnostic label to all these different kids. For one of the main causes of this attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is simply that the child can't see well and needs glasses. Another problem is that the children can't hear well and need hearing aids. But a big cause of it is just that the children can't read because they've not been taught.
Well, I don't want to make too much of a leap here, but in my experience, looking at the experience I've had coming into contact with the education system, other social systems, the inability to read and write can cause a level of frustration that's perhaps second only, if not on a par, to something like acute sexual frustration. Now, some people might be chuckling at that, but that kind of, you look at, for example, some problems that have arisen as a result of that in the Middle East. You know, there are certain human needs that we have, and, you know, communication is like so important. I see it just even from on a day-to-day basis with some of the other work that I do, coming into contact with people who are functionally illiterate, and it stunts everything they do.
And they feel nothing short of, extreme anger about this. And of course, this is going to have societal effects. So I'll just get you to give me your thought on that, but before we come on to talk about the other effects in a little bit more detail.
Well, of course, the natural reaction to this sort of thing is going to be either anger or shame. Shame is the feeling that is the emotional state that corresponds to being in a subordinate social position. So if you blame yourself for the problem, you're going to feel shame. If you blame other people for the problem, you're going to feel anger, and you should be angry.
Okay, so we've been talking about, say, everything from the ancient historical background of this development over the millennia. We've talked about the Prussian model, some sinister developments there that have been imported into the system, right through to bumbling incompetence, perhaps on some levels, if we can allow for that. At the top of the hour, we were talking about this functional illiteracy in modern society, specifically in North America. But all of this plays out into wider society, and this is what we're going to concern ourselves with from this point on. And we've talked somewhat about social effects, but I see it most acutely is in our political system, and that can be everything from the talking head politicians and commentators on our televisions and other media, right through to, political discussion debates in the bar between, a couple of guys, the potential voters, Now, the thing that is characterized, I've studied politics for decades, in different countries, but particularly here in the UK. And one of the most striking developments has been the deterioration in the level, the color, the character of public debate and discourse. And it's always been adversarial. I mean, you can go back, millennia. You could actually argue, well, at least, we're not physically fighting each other now across, the political divide. But it is very adversarial at the moment. And in fact, over in North America, we see this acutely now with the current early stages of the next presidential campaign. I mean, a lot of observers like myself on this side of the pond are looking on just aghast, thinking, oh my God, is it really going to be Trump versus Clinton when it comes round to it? So I don't know how you have, how you would connect the education system and the societal effects it has with political developments in terms of not just the debate, but the actual grasp of issues and to what extent issues actually get shoved aside. I would say in favor of other things. It's not really in favor, is it? But in favor of rhetoric, and I don't mean rhetoric in the good sense of the word.
Well, the kind of educational deprivation that comes from the suppression of the liberal arts creates political problems as well as personal problems, and it's really hard to sort the two out. When you have people who cannot think logically and who do not know basic facts about the world, they cannot, that's a personal problem for them. But in the aggregate, it's a huge problem for society because, they don't know how things work. They don't know, they become politically incompetent. For example, so many people are, they're angry because, the 1% are getting their way all the time. Well, of course they are. They have the means to buy their way through lots of things. Yes, they're going to be a problem all the time. But the 1% control only 1% of the vote. I mean, no matter how wealthy the Koch brothers are, David and whatever his name is, they only have one vote apiece. And if, they have their chosen candidates and so forth, well, if all the people who want some different kind of destiny for their country, want some kind of different life for themselves, they can outvote them. But people don't know how to, they don't know how to articulate their, they don't even know what they want. They don't know how to get what they want. And they don't know how to reason with each other to try to build consensus and then develop a political movement. I mean, it's, as Orwell said in 1984, the proles, that they cannot rise up until they become conscious, but they cannot become conscious until they rise up. So it's this process of what Paulo Freire called conscientization is an educational process. And without it, you cannot have democracy. I mean, if people don't know how things work, don't know how to articulate what they want, and don't know how to work through normal political processes to get what they want, they're politically incompetent.
Yeah, I remember us being involved in things like, debating society, for just as one example. And this was seen as relatively mundane. It was just something that you take part in. And I didn't fully grasp at the time what we were being encouraged to understand and to get better at, if you see what I mean. But listening to politicians today and comparing it to, for example, some of the discussions that we might have had over, oh God knows what subject back then. This is like, a handful of teenagers being encouraged to act like adults. I mean, it occurs to me that along the lines of what you just said, I mean, obviously in any political party, in any system, there are people with a very good grasp of what's going on. But I'm constantly surprised by, let's not mince words, okay? Watching the TV, listening to the radio, by how stupid some of these people appear to be. And I can only, again, not wishing to throw personal insults around, but why not just call a spade a spade? That's how it comes across. Just very, very poor grasp of detail of their supposed specialist subject and of the workings of the wider world.
Well, if you look at the dictionary and look at the dictionary definition of stupid, stupid means that the person can't solve problems. So in a manner of speaking, if you don't know basic facts about the world, don't know how to put those facts together in logical arguments to figure out a bigger picture of what's going on, and you don't know what to do about those things, so that you cannot solve your problems, you are, in a technical sense, stupid. That doesn't mean that you don't have enough brain cells to connect it together, that you would not be able to figure these things out. But it's for whatever reason you're not figuring these things out. And the usual reason is because you've been miseducated. There are a lot of people who, they may seem stupid when they talk about political things, but if you ask them about something like what they do at work, you see this weird mismatch between, competence in one aspect of their lives and just total incompetence in the political domain of their lives.
Yeah, I mean, think of, again, you can give your characterization of the US system, but here in the UK, the general feeling amongst a lot of great swathes of the public anyway is that the political class are an elite in more ways than one, and specifically that the education system that they experienced tended to be a privileged one. Now, of course, you've got politicians from the middle class or working class who went to schools very much that of the type that most people could relate to. But there's still this perception that, well, a lot of these people have been through elite schooling, so therefore they had an advantage and they're going to be at least one step ahead of us. But when I put this interview up, I'm going to link through to the show I did with Nick Duffel, a UK-based researcher, and he looked at elite schooling and the problems associated with that. And I then look at the US system and poor wretches like the idiot boy Bush Jr., and whatever privileges that so-called that he grew up with. And it's no longer even the case that, for example, you can put a child into any type of school you want. You can put them in a shack with, a chalkboard, or you can put them in a, $1 million a year private school, whatever it happens to be. It's teaching isn't, and the results aren't about necessarily, it's about the methods, isn't it, really? It's not about resources necessarily. This is why, for example, in many cases, homeschooling can have good outcomes.
I'm not, when I edit somebody's writing, when I edit something that someone has written, I do not know whether that person went to Catholic school or public school in the United States. I don't know whether they went to a state school or a private university or what have you. But I know if they can write. And so from my perspective, I don't care how the person got to know what they know. But I do notice if they don't understand where modifiers go in a sentence. I notice if they can't put their thoughts together in logical arguments. I notice if their writing is incoherent. I mean, this is these are things that you really need to learn. Now, how you learn them, you could learn them through homeschooling if your parents are well educated enough to give you that kind of education, and that's a darn big if. And you could learn it from a good public school if you're lucky enough to have a good public school. Or you could learn it from a good private school if you're lucky enough to be able to go to one. The problem is you really have to develop a set of skills and a certain set of knowledge, knowledge about facts. For example, if you're going to study chemistry and biology and so forth, you need to understand certain principles such as the conservation of mass and energy and that sort of thing. You have to understand those basic principles in order to get by in other things. I mean, you can't understand nutrition unless you understand thermodynamics, for example. So there are a lot of just basic facts about the world that you need to understand, but you also need to have some basic intellectual skills for thinking logically and expressing yourself rationally and so forth that really have to be taught and learned. I mean, these are things that people just don't develop spontaneously through unguided activities. I mean, these are things that have to be taught and learned, and people have to be given honest feedback about their level of skill. And that kind of teaching is often lacking in many different kinds of schools.
Where do you think the black and white nature of a lot of the current political discourse comes from? It's one of the things I find the most frustrating is this the loss of kind of subtlety, you know, because a coin has three sides, you know, a face and a reverse and an edge. And we talked about things being adversarial, but this comes down to actual, even if you do get into some sort of substantial debate, it's very much sort of, it's either this or it's that. And that seems to be, you know, you're either with us or you're with your terrorists, you know, that type of thing. Or it's like, do you agree or do you disagree? And decisions are taken on that basis. So where does that come from in terms of the system that we're characterizing?
Well, Orwell covered that in Animal Farm. Four legs good, two legs bad.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, he got the sheep were saying four legs good, two legs bad. And I mean, it's, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, there are think tanks within the American right wing that have been working for years to try to figure out, that have been working for years to reshape public discourse. So if Americans seem to be losing their minds to observers in Britain, it's because we've been falling prey to this kind of brain manipulation from this very powerful and very well-heeled political effort. So it's not an accident.
There was some reporting on the TV, was it today or yesterday? And, you know, they're doing sort of vox pops with various people at some conferences and speeches and what have you. It's again over in the US on the context of the presidential run, and there was some Ted Cruz. I mean, the fact that it's him is neither here nor there, really, but Ted Cruz supporters, it was a couple of ladies out saying, yeah, Ted Cruz. And they weren't able to actually name a single policy that he had. Ditto when it came to Trump. You know, there was this, Trump had literally got up and run whatever social class it was into the ground, and the yin had member of said social class stood outside, something like, I agree with everything Trump says, and she's standing outside the speech. He's in there talking, and she stood outside saying, I agree with everything he says. It's that type of thing that's, again, nothing new, but it's, we were supposed to be evolving beyond this point, and it seems kind of like, after all, that maybe our development isn't actually a straight line, it's actually cyclical.
Well, it seems to me that we've been degenerating into a bizarre form of feudalism.
Yes.
And I saw this in back in the during the primaries for the year 2000 elections. And I asked this fellow who was a Republican, I mean, not a stupid man by any stretch of the imagination, okay? But I mean, his politics differed from mine, which is okay. And so I asked him, well, who do you think is likely to win the Republican nomination? You know, not whom do you support, but who do you think is going to win? And he said, oh, George W. Bush. And I said, why? You know, why do you think he's going to win? And he said, well, you know, he's got experience as a businessman, and he comes from the right kind of family.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my goodness. And when, I mean, my, the member of Congress from our district here where I live, people are so impressed by him because he can trace his family back to rich people from a few generations back. I mean, there are things named after his family throughout this part of the world. So they've, you know, therefore they think it was appropriate for him to be, our member of Congress. And I asked him, well, what kind of policies does he support? And they have no idea. I mean, when they say, oh, well, he's good on this policy. And I said, well, actually, he voted against such and such piece of legislation. And they're shocked. I mean, they just have no idea. You know, it's like, well, you know, some scion of some rich family is in a position of power. Therefore, God's in his heaven. All's right with the world. I mean, they've lost their minds.
Well, it just today, I was listening to, this is a bit of political coverage here in the UK. It was regarding the mooted, well, I'll believe it when I see it, forthcoming vote in the UK, whether to remain within the European Union or to withdraw. And Prime Minister, current UK Prime Minister David Cameron was quoted, whenever it was, maybe last year, something like that sort of timescale, I'm paraphrasing here, as saying that my MPs will not be allowed to have a free vote on this issue, because that would just be untenable. It just wouldn't work. The party line, they will be obliged to vote with the party line. Currently, that has changed. They will be allowed to vote with their conscience or whatever other word you want to use, to either whatever way they want to do in this forthcoming referendum. And one of his chancellor was on the radio, and the interviewer was saying, why did he change his mind? And the chancellor said, well, he hasn't changed his mind. And I was going, well, of course he always changed his mind. Even the BBC guy, even this hack from the BBC said, well, I'm sorry, but here's the quote. Here we have him saying, can't have a free vote. Now he's saying you can. And Chancellor's going, well, yes, but of course, and off he goes on some other tack. This is what they do, you know. And this is what I find so, well, I can't even say the word frustrating because I've kind of withdrawn from this, but these things are never resolved. And maybe it's because of the pressure of time and the media. But what generally happens is they get to a certain point, and the guy from the BBC or whatever network it is goes, okay. And he moves on because he realizes he's not going to get anywhere. Now this has, for me, this has consequences. That's not just a ha ha ha, he didn't really answer the question. Black has become white, up is down.
Well, if you've got an if-then statement. If the person votes his conscience, then what? What do you mean they can't vote this way? They most certainly can. I mean, they can vote however they want, can't they?
Well, I should just explain that the system here would be, it's called a whipping system, whereby if you're part of a political party, you can be obliged, you know, on peril of losing your job to vote a certain way, actually, on certain issues. That's all.
Oh, so the thou shalt or else, you know, what's in the or else clause?
Yeah, it's basically.
Or else you will lose your seat.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Oh, well. Fall on your sword if it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. The point of it all was is that just the Prime Minister said one thing and then he just changed his mind. And that's another casualty of all this, is the ability to do something like change your mind. Because, again, it's seen as weakness, and that's an aspect of this black and white polarization thing, isn't it, really? You know, it's also an aspect of what I was saying earlier about the loss of subtlety.
Changing your mind thing. Orwell dealt with it, but I've seen it myself. People who have, I hate to use this word, fascist tendencies. The people who are authoritarian follower types, their personality type is that they want to just take orders from some strong leader. And this infuses their whole political life and a lot of their personal life as well. But they will believe what they're told. And the story that they're told can change in a twinkling, and they switch right around and you know, they don't miss a step. I mean, it's like at the peak of hate week in Orwell's 1984, when they found out that, we had always been at war with East, I forget whether it's Eurasia, East Asia, Eurasia, whatever. I mean, you keep switching back and forth. Winston Smith is the only person who's noticed that it's been switching. Everybody else, as soon as the switch happens, they think it's always been that way. And the one, the example that I saw of this myself was when that plane was exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland. And originally it was being blamed on the Iranians. And everybody knew that that Iran was responsible for this because, there was some reason given for it. But then the first Gulf War came along, and they needed to have some sort of, they needed to make nice with the Iranians for whatever reason. And then suddenly the story changed, and it was Libyans that were responsible for this. And it was like everybody, the news media turned on a dime. And suddenly it was before it had been Iran, 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 and then suddenly it's Libya, Libya, Libya. And I thought I had been kind of out of touch when the switch happened. So I just tuned in again, and then I heard all this stuff, this was done by Libyans, and I thought I'd lost my mind. So I went back and I looked it up, and sure enough, I mean, it originally been Iran, 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 then it was Libya, Libya, Libya. It's like, wait a minute, I mean, what... Why should we believe either of those stories? So it was very disorienting, and that was one of the reasons why I really stopped taking anything I heard in the press too seriously.
Have you seen the movie? I wouldn't be at all surprised if you haven't, but it's called Idiocracy.
Yes.
You have seen it, okay.
Yes.
It's just probably quite a frustrating thing to watch, but I feel like I'm living in that sometimes, because when I was listening to that radio segment I was describing earlier about the Chancellor sort of saying black is white and up is down, I was actually in the bath of all places, and if I hadn't been, I probably would have thrown the radio across the room, and perhaps if I had been not in the bath, I probably would have thrown the radio into the bath.
Put an end to your suffering.
But it seems that this brings me on to an issue then of being too engaged in some ways. Not too engaged in politics, because I think if you really engage in it, you do get lost. You then, you just go into this sort of labyrinth of nonsense and never to be seen again. But if you're standing off to one side trying to make sense of this, even just as an intellectual exercise, just to try and keep these people rigorous in their thinking, which is very, very difficult, you then realize how much of a minority you're in, and suddenly it becomes, well, if you're really interested in what words mean anymore, or what somebody actually said, or how consistent things are, you're kind of getting bogged down in a lot of intellectual stuff here, really. You've just got to go with how things actually are, if you see what I mean. A bit like, who was it that said, we create reality? It was one of your bigwigs, neocon guys. It was, Carl somebody or other? Carl Rove. I think it was Carl Rove. Something along the lines of, basically we create reality type thing. And in some ways, that's what it feels like. It doesn't matter how things actually are. It's like they are how we say. That's how they are.
Well, for people who've been, who've grown up in the bubble, as it were, where daddy's money has always been able to solve problems, to them that kind of thinking works. Until they get into a position, where it doesn't, and suddenly everything goes pear-shaped and they're surprised.
How concerned are you about that sort of the effects on wider society? Because one of my pet hates is a kind of dilution I referred earlier just a moment ago about, in terms of what words actually mean. Because for me, it's very important that we hold on to that, because language is not only how we communicate, but it's actually we think in terms of language, if you see what I mean. We formulate concepts. That's how we interact. We're not telepathic. We've kind of left behind symbolism as ways to communicate. Symbols can be much more subtle and they can mean more than one thing at once, if you see what I mean. But language is black and white on one level. And in the book, you were saying that you weren't overly bothered about text speak, for example. And that's one of my one of my pet hates, because in that I see the seed of language becoming distorted to the point where, you do mention this in the book about encouraging everyone to look up words in the dictionary that you use, because I've done this absolutely as a writer. I have done this. I've used a word and then realized at some point that it doesn't actually mean what I meant, but it's in my mind, it always meant that and it was wrong, or it gradually morphed into something over time. So I'm just, despite what I just said, I'm a bit of a pedant when it comes to these things. Ditto with punctuation, because if I read on a a chalkboard outside a restaurant that they've got, you know, a choice of soups, S-O-U-P apostrophe S. That reads differently to me than it does without the apostrophe. Now, I can grasp the context and understand what is trying to be communicated, but nevertheless, my brain processes it as something else. But for increasing numbers of people, it seems that that doesn't matter, and I come across this all the time. And as in my role as an editor, I've not done editing professionally for some time now. And in fact, a lot of the popularization of the web as a place to publish criticism, which is what I was dealing with, has really come along in the years since I stopped being a professional editor. And I've noticed a marked deterioration in what people find acceptable in terms of, there's a piece of writing. I've published that online. It's fine. And this is not somebody's personal blog. This is a website they've taken some time over. There's their piece of artistic criticism. And I'm like, whoa, this is off the charts bad. You know, sentences starting with small letters, that type of thing. Misleading punctuation all over the place. So this is a bit of a long screed, but just remember you saying you weren't overly bothered by tech speak. But what concerns you and what doesn't concern you? What's good, bad, and indifferent in the way that you see our use of language and how it affects our ability to think going forward?
Well, I don't mind people using shorthand for the purpose of using shorthand. And that when people, the kind of weird spellings and so forth that people are using when they're texting is, as far as I'm concerned, a form of shorthand. Now, I mean, the women my mother's age used to learn shorthand in school so that they could work in offices and so forth. And it didn't undermine their ability to use language, the fact that they could also, you know, take shorthand. I mean, that was not a problem, so I don't view that as a problem. What I do see as a problem is some of the culture that's growing up on the web, where people who have no education in a subject have come to the conclusion that they can express opinions about some technical subject, and that they can debunk the work of somebody who has dedicated their life to some project. For example, there was a young woman who was an English major, I don't even know if she finished college, who had taken it upon herself to debunk the work of one of the world's foremost nutritional epidemiologists. I mean, this is a guy who's a professor emeritus at an Ivy League university. He's been working on NIH grants, and they don't give out NIH grants to idiots. I mean, it's a very competitive process to get that grant money. He was the one of the lead authors on this, on a lot of this huge project called the China Cornell Oxford Project, and yet here's this woman who has obviously not taken even an introductory level course in statistics, who takes it upon herself to debunk his work, and then other people are telling me, oh, well, you shouldn't listen to this great authority because you should listen to this idiot girl. And I'm thinking, what? I mean, have you lost your mind? I mean, where's the respect for scholarship?
Well, one thing that I found most interesting is how vox pops have changed over the years. And I mentioned earlier about this, you know, going back and reading a Victorian newspaper or an, you know, equivalent era newspaper from the US, and how the language is different and how arguments are framed differently. I remember when I first started to pay attention to current affairs, and it was probably, you know, earlier than most people would really, you know, sort of as a teenager, and thinking back now to people being stopped in the street and asked their opinion on things, comparing that to now and how things have changed over the years, it seems to have almost crossed over now into a willful celebration of ignorance. I mean, I don't think that's too strong a phrase. You mention in the book how people have kind of spoofed this or lampooned it or tried to make a point by making us laugh at it. You gave the examples of Howard Stern and Jay Leno,
yes,
two well-known American TV personalities. We have the equivalent over here as well. And I'm never quite sure where on the spectrum an uncomfortable member of the public is when they are kind of giggling when they don't know something or they get something wrong, how much of it is deep discomfort at their own ignorance or whether it's really transcended that and they're just beyond all that and really it is kind of actual enjoyment. Whether it's even a stage beyond that, whether or not even they don't even know what they don't know anymore, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, well, I go by their facial expressions. They are not. It's not fear I see. It's smugness. I mean, they're proud of not knowing for the most part. I mean, they're not afraid of embarrassing themselves in public at all. I mean, a lot of these people, a lot of them are just, they're proud that they don't know things. They're proud to not be the nerds. They're proud to not be the smart kid in the room.
Yeah, that's a really important issue, actually, this whole nerd thing. I don't know where that, I mean, bullying and stuff like that's been around for years. There's lots of reasons why bullying takes place, for example, in schools, but a lot of it is around this issue of learning. I remember kids, I used to have to walk under an old railway bridge on the way home from school, and kids from the other school who didn't, you know, maybe the system, victimized them in one way. You know, they didn't make it through a certain exam, which had been a high-pressure exam on one afternoon, which would decide the course of the rest of their educational lives, throwing things at me and calling me a snob. And I'm thinking, why is that? What is it that makes you uncool that you like reading books? It's not mutually exclusive with these other things. You know, I mean, you can be interested in cars and sport and girls and stuff and books as well, if you know what I mean. There's a cliched image of a nerd, glasses and a bookworm and no good at any of the aforementioned other things, if you see what I mean. And then there's the image of the jock, you know what I mean, sort of the willfully dumb guy. But he's, you know, good at sports and he gets the girl and he's got a nice car. I never saw these things as all mutually exclusive. It's a spectrum, if you see what I mean. So, but on the other hand, the school experience I had, I'd see people who were less, or should say more able, more easily intimidated than myself, less able to perhaps verbally joust with some of these people. And their lives being made an absolute misery simply because they had a passion for reading and learning about things they didn't know about before, whatever the subject would happen to be, you know, arts, science. Where does that come from? You see, because that doesn't sit easily with the ancient traditions that we started out talking about, you know, where the well-rounded, man it would have been at that time, you know, the well-rounded human being with these different skills in different areas, and some people excel at some things that others don't. But, you know, the well-rounded education and the physical, the mental, the emotional, the artistic, all these things that go to make up the human experience. What the hell happened? was it because of some scientific elite that were perceived to be running amok? I mean, the dystopian fiction's full of that, isn't it? You know, the scientists did this to us, God damn them, you know, and that's the guy in the lab coat then becomes demonized. I just don't know where this came from.
Well, I think it relates to something called the motivational triad, where human beings, like other organisms, are pretty much wired to follow three basic rules. We try to seek pleasure, avoid pain, and conserve energy. Now, some people get a lot of pleasure out of reading books and learning things, and some people not so much. For them, they wouldn't get that much pleasure out of learning something, and to them it would be a waste of energy. So they're not going to bother. Then they see that these other people who are actually enjoying reading or what have you are, I don't know, getting better grades or something, and then they feel jealous and angry. So so you end up with basically narcissistic rage being thrown at you.
But there's other, you know, there's other, this is and this does happen in some cases. If you don't like reading and learning, you're really not interested in thinking about concepts or about the world. If your passion is baseball, then become the best baseball player you can be. You can succeed that way. If your passion is cars, then become the best goddamn mechanic or car designer or whatever it happens to be. You see, you know, there's all these different routes, but I don't know, maybe again, that's a dysfunction of the system as to what options are open to people, you know, because there was a time when practical skills, vocational education was very much favored, then that fell out of favor. In fact, one of the issues I see with the education system now is that kids are being kind of groomed and steered for jobs and careers that are not really there anymore. I don't have kids myself, but I've said to friends of mine, I've said to their kids, you're, you know, sort of coming of age. Just my opinion, of course. I'm not trying to, you know, butt in. But, you know, ask yourself why you're studying what you're studying, because a case could be made now that, and this is not, you can do whatever you like to educate yourself in your own time. But as far as the formal education system is concerned, you know, think carefully about what you want out of it and don't be steered, because if maybe now would be a great time to become a metal worker, you know, maybe you could actually become employed, where if you line up with all the others to do business management, you know, well, you might find yourself in an extremely competitive market. And not everyone can be burger flippers either. You know, there's a limit to how many of those we need.
Well, that's, I mean, the whole question of vocational education is a tough one, because you have to predict the future. And who's good at that? I mean, it used to be that you just did what your parents did. Now you have to choose a career and find your fortune in the wide world. So it's, I mean, that's a tremendously difficult question. I can't even begin to answer that. I mean, I would not recommend that anybody go into what I do for a living here in the United States, because that work is all being shipped off to India, where people will do the same kind of work for less.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons why I said I was a former editor, because it's difficult to get. Doing it freelance has become untenable, and getting a paid job doing it like full time is almost out the window as well. And as you say, it's been shipped around the world. That's another issue, of course, but it still overlaps with what I was saying about an education system that's training kids or pushing kids in a direction, you know, that's basically off a cliff for many of them, really, or certainly not where they think they're going to be.
Well, that's certainly alienating. That could account for a lot of people's dissatisfaction of, I mean, if the school is not, to use a term that was popular in the 60s, relevant, I mean, if the education is not meaningful, it's not useful, then they have every right to be angry at the waste of their time and the opportunity, the opportunity cost of studying something that they won't be able to use.
And of course, running parallel to this is the great college loan scandal. I don't know if anyone in the US is referring to it like that, but certainly from this angle, I see a lot of problems being stored up there. You know, sort of, there was a time when, you know, obviously education's never been free. Somebody's always paying for it. You know, somebody builds the school, somebody pays the teachers. But it seems now that, for the sort of, you know, mismatched education I've just described, that a lot of young people are going to be 30, 40, 50 grand in the hole. And if they're lucky, flipping burgers, and good luck trying to pay that off.
Well, I think that this was a matter of deliberate policy in the United States. This change from affordable higher education to unaffordable higher education. I think it was a reaction to public unrest during the Vietnam War, and I mean, we had uprisings on college campuses and so forth. I mean, their young people were infuriated over the draft and the war and so forth. And the people who decide these things thought about it. And shortly after that, then the cost of education started to rise sharply. So sharply that for a lot of working class people, if they wanted to get an education, they had to volunteer for the military. You know, there wasn't a war on at the time. So a lot of people said, well, I might as well go into the army. There's no war on, and I'll do my time, and then I'll be able to pay for college that way. And it's heavily sold to young people in the working class areas that, you know, you do this so that you can go to college. And so on one hand, that the other sources of funding for college dried up, so that people and the students and their families ended up having to pay more and more the cost of higher education. So this seemed like an opportunity to, or, you know, so then they would say, well, you know, here, go into the military so that you can go to school. So instead of people going to college to get out of being drafted, you had people going into the military so that they could go to college.
There's a lot of that now here in the UK. It's not unusual to see in a town centre in any given weekend, the army, usually the army, sometimes the other, the air force or whatever, but they've set up a little booth, you know, a little gazebo on the high street, and they're there giving out leaflets. And a lot of it's orientated around, because even just to look at the pictures, the big photos they have, showing a lot of young people doing things other than, in fact, anything but fighting.
And, oh, yes.
Yeah, and the emphasis there is skills and transferable skills. And it seems to be, you know, what will happen when you come out of the military, the opportunities available to you. And that's a very strong, even as they lay off soldiers, they're still, you know, that seems to be, they're still looking to suck in 16-year-olds.
Well, the a lot of the military skills that, you know, a lot of the skills are just, are simply not transferable. And one of the reasons for this is that even the skills that you'd think would be transferable are not being done by people who are uniformed members of the military. So a lot of those things that would help you develop skills that would be transferable, those jobs are being done by civilian contractors.
Mm-hmm.
So the chance of you learning something that would be useful, if, I mean, that's some resume building type of work, something that would you know, give you a trade that then you could support a family on afterwards. That's the chances of you developing that through military service, you know, may not be as good as you'd hope.
All right. I think today we've been discussing the education system. That's been the kind of the headline topic, and all the different areas that we've got into. It really emphasizes just how far-reaching this is in society and in our politics, and everything's just interconnected in that sense. We could discuss this all day. Any one particular topic we've taken here, we could spend an hour talking about. But before we finish up for today, what gives you cause for optimism, you know, however guarded? For example, do you see potential with the internet? I often hear former lecturers or educators talking about the opportunities in distance learning and how it's just not necessary to incur enormous debts in order to get a good qualification, particularly a relevant one for the individual concerned. As far as society is concerned, wider society, we have the rise of independent media now. That relates to the internet, of course. You can reach the same size audience, theoretically speaking, with one little web page as ABC or NBC or the BBC or any of them. So just, again, what gives you cause for optimism?
Well, a few months ago, I got an email from a Protestant bishop from Mississippi who had read my book, and he was pleased to announce that his church was putting into place the recommendations that I made in the last chapter of Not Trivial, namely that they were going to develop curricula and so forth to train, to help people study for the AP exams. So this would essentially turn their church into its own junior college. Now, the advanced placement, I don't know if they have it in Britain. It's a program here in the United States where you presumably would take a course in your high school, but you don't have to. And you take a, you sit for an exam, and if you score well on that exam, then you can get college credit for that learning experience. If you score high on the exam, you can either get credits toward graduation from college, or you can at least fulfill some of your requirements. So, for example, if you'd score 5 on the AP English, you might not have to take a grammar composition course in college and so forth. So this is actually the best value in higher education in the United States is the advanced placement program. You can get a lot of the course materials for preparing for these examinations very cheaply. And, of course, if you've got an organization like a church, which is preparing people for this, they can reuse the materials year after year. So the fact that that small organizations can do this, churches, labor unions, social organizations, and so forth, could help kids prepare for the AP exams and get some college credit that way, I think that's tremendously important. And if people study for the... if you have more and more people taking advanced placement history and economics and English in, I think the world would be much better off, because then you'd really have an informed electorate. You'd really have voters who can actually make sensible votes on economic issues.
And we didn't even touch upon economic literacy as a pet subject of mine. I have to save that for another time. But
We can. And then there's the whole field of nutrition, and then there's the whole... I mean, I've just come out with two new books. One is Thin Diabetes, Fat Diabetes, which is how to prevent type 1 and cure type 2 diabetes. And then there's a book, No More Measles, which encourages people, please do vaccinate your children according to the recommended vaccination schedule. And we should be working on eradicating measles, mumps, and rubella, because after that, we won't need the MMR vaccine anymore.
Well, once this goes up, I expect to get some, field a few criticisms about that, because I know vaccines are very divisive. But again, that's a debate for another day. Today, we've been talking about your book, Not Trivial, How Studying the Traditional Liberal Arts Can Set You Free. You've got a website devoted to that. You mentioned your other two books. Share any websites or any other resources you'd like to put out there for folks.
Okay, perfect. It's my website for Not Trivial is www.nottrivialbook.com. My website for my diabetes book is www.thindiabetes, as in skinny, thindiabetes.com. And the other one is nomeasles.com.
Splendid. Well, Laurie, thank you once again so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you very much.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's legalize-freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com. Thank you.